Well, good morning again. excuse me. Juniper, man. I didn't know that was a problem until we moved here to Albuquerque. So Luke, as he's narrating this moment, it says 8 days after these things. Okay? Which means that we need to ask, what things? And as it turns out, the answer to that is a lot. Jesus does a bunch of healing. He sends his disciples out. He commissions the 12. And they're amazed at the power that he has given them. Then Jesus feeds 5,000 people. And they start traveling, and Jesus asks the famous question, who do you think I am? And not in that defiant, who do you think I am? But in the probing, who do you think I am? And Peter, for once, gets it right. And he says, you're the Messiah, you're the Christ. Effectively saying, you're the one we've been waiting for countless generations. And then Jesus twists that and says, first, I will be betrayed and handed over to the powers that be, and they will torture and kill me. And on the third day, I will be raised. And then 8 days later, we find ourselves on this mountain. Now, this passage, this whole discussion about the transfiguration, is one of those very rich, very complex passages because it brings together so many moments in the history of Israel. But it does it in such a way that there aren't a lot of like direct quotes. It's more like, it smells like the Hebrew Bible. There are hints, suggestions. Now, Luke is, as far as we can tell, Gentile. And the reason why I mention that is this is a very distinctly Jewish way of writing. They like to suggest and hint and let you figure it out. It's called remez. And I think one of the effects that has on reading through the Transfiguration for us modern people is that we can pick out the major moments, but once we start probing and asking questions like, yeah, but what does it really mean? What's really going on here? Why does Peter want to build these tents? Why Moses and Elijah? The answers that we might be able to give start to get a little thin. And so it's better, I think, to focus just on a couple of details and then ask ourselves the question that Jesus asked right before this moment, which is, who is he? Because our answer to the question of who is Jesus will dramatically shape everything in our lives, one way or the other. And this is true, I'm convinced, for quite literally everybody. Not just those here in the room. First off, why were the disciples asleep? Did you notice that? They missed most of this. And one of the stronger possibilities is actually not that deep. It's probably because Jesus has a tendency to go off and pray at night, and it's nighttime. I'd fall asleep too. I mean, I would hopefully do it in such a way where it looks like I'm praying. You know, kind of like when you were in school and you were tired at your desk, you would go like this so it looked like you were reading, but no, you were gone. maybe. And also, Moses and Elijah, at what point do they realize that Jesus is human? Have you ever stopped to think about that? It's now, the Bible is typically doesn't have a lot to say about that immediate moment after we die. We know that we are in Jesus. If we die in Jesus, and that is by definition heaven, that's a better place than ever anywhere. But we don't get a lot about what, you know, how conscious are we, what we're aware of. We don't get a sense that we're like watching things unfold on earth or something like that. That would be, I think, very frustrating to me anyway. But maybe I'm a control freak. But regardless, it seems like they would have understood Jesus' divinity. And at what point do they understand his humanity? If they are conscious, which I don't really think they were, I don't know, then they would have seen it in the moment of the incarnation, when Jesus is implanted in Mary's womb. There's actually a very ancient church tradition that has a long, interesting history that states that it's actually right now, in the moment of transfiguration, where suddenly they are learning that Jesus is not just divine, he is also human. And as such, he has a very human mission. In fact, he has a mission to accomplish that only a human being could do. Because throughout the history of Israel, if a goat dies in your place, it doesn't change. It changes things for a little bit. And it will take the great Saint Augustine to point out that no, it actually needs to be a human to die in your place. So Moses and Elijah at some point have learned something. That maybe this God, this divine being, this member of the Trinity, in a shocking twist, has become human. Now, the disciples sleeping, as I would anyway, I don't know if you would, they come to, and how do they know that that's Moses and Elijah? I'm guessing they don't have name tags, and Moses and Elijah haven't been around for a very long time. The most probable reason would be that Jesus told them eventually. But I don't know. Regardless, they know Jesus up until now as a miracle worker, as somebody who feeds the masses. That would, by the way, sound a little like Moses. The miracle worker, that would sound like a whole bunch of the prophets. And yet even some people in Jesus' own day. A great teacher, we've had those. Somebody who has this sense that he is going to have to give everything for the sake of his people. That's uncommon, but it's not unheard of. In other words, they, up until this point, see Jesus as somebody who is extraordinary and human. And so they wake up, you know, rub their eyes, whatever. It usually takes me a good solid hour to kind of come to before I can really have a conversation. And they see the guy that they know as a human being, doing all the normal human being things, as their rabbi, their teacher, that they have followed for at least some time now. And they see him talking with these two in dazzling white. And now they're faced with the question, who is this guy? Like, yeah, he's the Messiah, and all of the Jewish traditions state that the Messiah is, he's human, he's the Son of Man. He's not the Son of God, or at least not explicitly. And then there he is. So Peter, James, and John are learning some things too. Everybody's learning some things, except for Jesus. And it's unfortunate that the ESV, our translation here, says that Jesus is talking to them about his upcoming departure in Jerusalem. And that's unfortunate for a couple of reasons. One, just the way the English works, you know, it evolves and changes based on context. And so when we think like departure in Jerusalem, we might think somewhere in the back of our heads, like, I didn't know Jerusalem had an airport at that time. Because that's what departure means. And the reason why it's really unfortunate that they translated it that way is that the word in Greek is actually exodus. It's actually the genitive, exodu, but it's exodus. Something Moses would know a thing or two about. That whatever is going on, and Jesus has already started hinting and alluding and then just telling his disciples and they continue to miss it, that as Jesus is making his way toward Jerusalem, some things are going to go really, really, really wrong. Now, Peter, as he is building these tents, it's not 100% clear why. It's clear that he wants to stay in that moment. And frankly, I don't blame him. At least one divine being is shining up there in front of me. I would want to stay in that moment too. But other than that, it's not entirely clear. And the language here, I won't get into it, is just riddled with the way that the Hebrew Bible will talk about the presence of God, the manifest, tangible presence in the tabernacle in the wilderness built by Moses and the temple in Jerusalem built by Solomon. The whole passage is just riddled with this. And often you would call it a tent, the tabernacle at least. But I think more likely is that this is a reference to the practice once a year for a week of the Jewish people, and this includes modern Jewish people as well, to construct these booths or tents outside, and in doing so, they commemorate and remember the time when their ancestors had been rescued from slavery in Egypt and were wandering in the wilderness and therefore lived outside. It's a way of reenacting what has already happened. And I think Peter's problem, the reason why Luke inserts that he didn't know what he was saying, and Peter often doesn't understand what he is saying, is that he thinks that what Jesus is going to accomplish is already finished. He wants to commemorate this moment. But we as the readers standing outside of the narrative know that, oh, there's more to come. And as we are on the cusp of Lent, we're going to spend 6 weeks in that more to come. And so the reason why Peter is wrong is not because he just wanted to stay in that moment. Why wouldn't you? But rather because he wants to commemorate something that's not finished yet. And very, very shortly, Luke, as narrating, will say, Jesus then set his face towards Jerusalem, and That's the pivotal moment. Jesus' days are now numbered. Now, as I said at the beginning, this has some implications for us today when we ask the question, who is Jesus? And if I asked you, who is Jesus? What would you say? Because there are a lot of correct ways to answer this. There are essentially no complete ways to answer this. We could say he is the second person of the Trinity, only begotten of the Father. Actually, we're going to say something like that as we confess the Nicene Creed shortly. God of God, light of light, very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father. Okay, great, fine. What does that actually mean? A lot of that focuses on the fact that Jesus is divine. And so if I were to ask, who is Jesus? A lot of us would say he's the Son of God, which is not wrong, of course. Some of us might also say he is also fully human, and that is a mystery. Some of us might say that he, as a human being, identifies with my own humanity, my own humanness. And if we want to pull from, say, the writer of Hebrews, we could say that he was tempted like me, but the difference being he didn't fail, and my story is one of failure. But widen that circle a little bit. Or move it outside of the distinct boundaries of a church. We could say that Jesus was a great teacher. He was. In fact, he was such a great teacher that there are things that he said that have just worked their way into the English language and in such a deep way that most people don't even realize that they are quoting Jesus, which I find fascinating. If you find yourself on one particular end of the political spectrum, you could say, well, Jesus was a radical who spoke truth to power, who was incredibly critical of those who hoarded wealth and those who were in power. You could say that, and you would not be wrong, especially with Luke. Luke is unkind to the wealthy, and there are some... Well, most of the time they deserve that in that era. Or if you are of another more or less political persuasion, you could say, well, Jesus valued the things that had come before him. He was not interested in abolishing the law and the way that society was structured. In fact, he even says that he came to fulfill this law. Because the past contains immense wisdom. And our job is to honor and continue to live in the past set out by our spiritual forebears. You could say that. You would also not be wrong. That was Jesus too. You could say that Jesus identified with the down and out. He fed the hungry. He healed those who were in desperate need of healing. He occasionally did befriend the extraordinarily wealthy and powerful. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea were Pharisees who were wealthy. Nicodemus, we know from other ancient writings, they were unique. In that regard. In other words, Jesus has this confounding ability to, in some ways, elude our comprehension. And if we find ourselves saying, I know exactly who Jesus is. I can tell you, I can answer that question of who is Jesus completely. Then what we tend to have done is constructed a Jesus that looks a lot like us. And in fact, the long-running history of the church is one of people struggling to break away from looking at the face of Jesus and instead seeing a reflection of ourselves. Or to put another way, we as human beings will always have the temptation to create God in our own image. And the reason why this is really, really important is not because we're just trying to do the task of a theologian and get things right. But instead, if we are not constantly challenged by Jesus, then what we miss is the opportunity to grow, to better understand even ourselves. Because Jesus is also described as our Creator. There was a, I think it was a podcast. I just saw like a little bit of it this week. And it's not something I would normally, it's not something I normally listen to, but it was on just general spirituality was the topic. It's not something I'd recommend necessarily either. And it was by somebody who and they would not deny this, which is important, that they look at the broad spectrum of human spiritual experience, and they take, you know, well, they like this idea about this, and they like this from this religious tradition, and then they like this about that, and so they, you know, kind of build their own sort of spiritual experience, however you want to say it. And that was, and as they were explaining it, it was fine. You just kind of think, well, I mean, if I did that, I could make life a lot easier on me. And then everything got derailed when somebody in that conversation posed the question. But, and that question was, how does that ever challenge you to grow? How does that ever evoke change in who you are? Because I don't know about you, but the times when I'm really comfortable are not times that I typically grow as a person. The times that I grow as a person are the times when I am staring at myself in a mirror and I have something pointed out in me that I don't like. And Christians are not immune. Because again, the question, who is Jesus really, really just invites a description of ourselves in some ideal sort of way. But Jesus, as he appears suddenly to his disciples as they are waking up, transfigured and therefore suddenly not who they thought he was in some really hard to understand way, and it's going to be quite some time before they can really verbalize what is going on here, will continue to challenge everybody he encounters. The you don't have the state execute somebody who just taught everyone how to be spiritually comfortable. And so my hope and prayer for us as we enter into a season, the season of Lent, is that we're challenged by who Jesus is really. What are the parts of Jesus? What are the parts of his life? The things that he said, do you just frankly not like? Like, love your enemies? We talked about that last week. No, I don't want to. But if I learn to do that, I will grow. Live a life of generosity? Instead of just grabbing everything I can to have mine and be comfortable, I'd rather not, because I don't want to be comfortable. Do I fight against change as God's Spirit is moving in me, in my community, in my broader city, or however you want to define that? I know I'm not supposed to, but I really like the way things are right now. Each opportunity that we have when we are confronted with who Jesus is, really, will be an opportunity to love him more dearly. To better understand that when Jesus says to Peter, "You're right, I'm the Messiah, and I'm going to provoke those with all the power and wealth in the land, and they are going to kill me in the most grotesque way possible, and this has to happen in order for you to be free." The more that we can wrap our minds and our hearts around this and understand what it means and what he did for us, the more our capacity to love and to grow. So may Jesus surprise us all as we enter into Lent and make our way to that dark day on that Friday and out the other side on that bright and shining day on that Sunday. Amen.